Blog Talk Radio.
Occult Empire on the Antimatter Zone Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of Occult Empire. I am your host, Bob from Cincinnati, and tonight is a great night lined up for Occult Empire. This is Occult Empire episode 006 for Monday, April 23rd, and once again, I welcome everybody for showing up. As stated, this is a cannot-miss show. This is going to be a groundbreaking episode on the Rosicrucian mystery tradition with Mark Passio. And tonight we are going to delve into everything esoteric about Rosicrucianism or Rosicrucians or the Rosicrucian tradition. And that was kind of a difficult search term when I did some research over the last month. I'd like to preface that the information that I present this evening will be exoteric material to be sure. And that's why I am so jazzed about this evening, because Mark Passio, for the first time, is going to start to share his information on Rosicrucian, the Rosicrucian mystery tradition or the mystery school for the Rosicrucians. And so this is exciting. And I told him off air that I am honored that he will use Occult Empire as the vehicle to do that. So once again, I'm thanking Mark for showing up. You have reached us this evening on Antimatter Broadcasting, which is the new channel for its sister ship, the Antimatter Zone Network. So welcome aboard, so to speak, if you made it. If you just made it to Antimatter Zone Network, be sure to stop on over to Antimatter Broadcasting, where other shows can be found there. All the new shows for Antimatter Zone Network will be found at Antimatter Broadcasting. We might move back to Antimatter Zone Network on Blog Talk. It just depends. But it was nice to mix it up and open the door a little bit. As stated, tonight's topic, the Rosicrucian mystery tradition. What Rosicrucian? What does that mean? We've heard that term for so long, the rose cross, a red cross, or a cross with a rose in the center of it. What does this mean? I'm still trying to discern all this, to be honest with you. If we go back in the history a touch, or a bit, quite a few hundred years, to be honest with you, there were three documents that were released successively in the year 1614, 1615, and 1616 in Germany that shocked the reading public. And of course, you know, that was a smaller public back then. But these three esoteric documents hit the scene in Germany in the heart of Europe, and it shocked the reading crowd. They were called the Fama Fraternitatis of 1614, the Confessio Fraternitatis of 1615, and the Chemische Hochzeit von Christiani Rosenkreuz. I'll break that down as the chemical wedding, or I should say the alchemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreuz, of the Rose and Cross fame, because in German, Kreuz translates as cross. Of course, rose is easy to catch there. This was shocking to people. It seemed that an esoteric order had plunged through the veil to reveal some mysteries to the reading public in Europe at that time. And it, like I said, it was a shocker. And I'm wondering if Passio will be able to comment on these. If not, no worries, because I know his material has more to do with the spiritual nature, which can I veil my hunger to hear it? and I'm going to kind of lay back this evening a bit, only interjecting intermittently with the information that I've gleaned to kind of give some historical backdrop to his information. But as stated, I am stoked to hear what Mark has to say. So when these documents hit the people in Germany in the early 1600s, let me read a little paragraph from the one, Confessio Fraternitatis of 1615. Quote, "What think you, loving people, and how seem you affected, seeing that you now understand and know that we acknowledge ourselves truly and sincerely to profess Christ, condemn the Pope, addict ourselves to the true philosophy, lead a Christian life, and daily call, and treat and invite many more unto our fraternity, unto whom the same light of God likewise appeareth." So it was a call out to others to join this hidden fraternity. And that's one thing I've gathered reading all this Rosicrucian material over the last month, is that it's a looser-knit fraternity. It's not the hard line, you know, it's not the linear angle of masonry, so to speak. It's more of a soft circular curve than the hard right angle of masonry, if I could make a very poor analogy. These seem to be I've heard it termed as the invisible brotherhood, the Rosicrucians. Some have said that the Royal College or the Royal Society in England was precursored by the Rosicrucians, that it was basically founded by this invisible college of Rosicrucians. And I'm not sure. I'm trying to discern all this as well. So I ask others to seek out this information and to make heads or tail of it. You know, one of the more modern Rosicrucian histories was written by an author by the name of Christopher McIntosh, M-C-I, N as in Nancy, T as in Tom O, S as in Sam H. His book, The Rosicrucians, The History, Mythology, and Rituals of an Esoteric Order. I just wanted to read a quote out of his book. I think it kind of sums up a bit of the mystery. The quote, "The durability of Rosicrucianism has partly to do with the appealing quality of the rose cross motif. The rose and cross individually have been given various interpretations. In Christian symbolism, they are sometimes found representing the Virgin Mary and Jesus Christ, as in a prayer inspired by the Litany of Loreto, which refers to the rose as flower of the cross, pure womb that blossoms over all blooming and burning, sacred rose, Mary." So it was, it has a real Christian connotation to it. Now, Mark and I brought up the famed alchemist Carl Jung on the last episode of that we did together, which was Occult Empire, episode 003, Mark Passio, Alchemy. And I hope that's a part one. I haven't really had time to discuss it with Mark, but I hope that's a part one and that we could expand a little bit further. But Carl Jung, the famed alchemist, is written by Christopher McIntosh, quote, "has shown that the rose is a symbol lying deep in the collective unconscious, which represents the maternal womb," once again the womb theme, "and perfection achieved by balance." Aha! And I'm wondering if that sounds familiar. A balancing of the hemispheres, a balancing of the Kabbalistic pillars to the center or middle chamber, as my good new friend Frater X, his show is called The Middle Chamber. But the cross, that was my own interjection, quote again, "the cross is an equally deep-seated symbol linked with the tendency for man's inner consciousness to seek fourfold patterns. It appears in mythologies all over the world in its Christian manifestation. It symbolizes suffering and sacrifice." And I'm wondering if that holds water for Mark. Now, the last piece that I would like to interject before we go into the intermission to pull Mark Passio on, what of the Rose Cross as symbolized by the arch nemesis of William Cooper, the Knights Templar? Aha, knights in white satin. Oh, my gosh, I apologize for singing that to you. But that theme has to do with the Rose Cross on a white woolen tunic. Yes, a Rose Cross. And so out of all my reading, I have yet to find a correlation or correspondence or relationship between Rosicrucianism and the Knights Templar. Now, of course, the Knights Templar are, you know, all part of the esoteric mystery, so they have to be connected in some way. But as to the direct connection between the Rose Cross of the Knights Templar and the Rosy Cross of the Rosicrucians, I've yet to find any linkage, and I'm hoping, once again, that Mark might be able to expand upon this. So it is a mystery, and that's why they call it the mystery schools, but I think that the school is coming into session, and it's best that we just bring Mark Passio on. So I've been notified a shrouded figure, a hooded figure, is at the door. So let's open the door to a cult empire to Mark Passio and Rosicrucianism. And indeed, the Fire Witch has been summoned back, but this time, instead of the Court of the Crimson King, it is indeed the Court of Occult Empire. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring back with great pleasure and honor my friend and mentor, Mark Passio.
Bob, thanks so much for having me back to Occult Empire. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here.
Oh, it is our honor, sir, and pleasure every time. Mark, I made it very clear in my introduction that I am still a fumbling student in the world of the Rosicrucian mystery or the Rosicrucian tradition, and I'm hoping that this evening you'll be able to clarify and expose and expand that rose on that cross that is an enigma to most of us this evening. I hope you can do that, sir.
I will do my absolute best to do that, as I will attempt to do in revealing some of the other allegories and symbols of this great mystery tradition known as Rosicrucianism. And I'll start by basically saying that it is indeed an occult tradition. Occult, of course, meaning hidden, derived from the Latin occultare, meaning to hide or to keep secret. And it is simply occult or hidden knowledge. And we have to first make the distinction that that, of course, only means that it has heretofore been kept secret or it is not generally known. And that does not imply that it is necessarily bad or evil in any way. This is often a misinterpretation by many people, and many people are turned off when they hear the word occult. That's a form of mind control in and of itself, which pushes people away from delving into some of these traditions and really getting to the alchemical gold at the center of these traditions, which could really help us to improve the quality of our life and really understand things so much better about how the universe really operates and really get to the heart of how we operate, because that's what this tradition is actually all about. It is about self-knowledge, learning about the self, learning about our motivations and desires and wants and the things that we need to do to change our behavior such that a quantum shift will take place in our reality and our quality of life and our conditions that we're experiencing in life will change for the better. So with that having been said, what people really need to first understand about the Rosicrucian tradition or the Rosicrucian mysteries in general is that it is the esoteric Christian tradition. It has deep ties with the original Christian tradition, okay? And it also goes back even much older than that, because the true Christic tradition goes back to before the time of the turn of the first century, when the teacher known as Jesus or the Christ was said to have lived. These teachings are indeed even more ancient than that and go back for thousands of years, right back into the human ancient past, into Egypt, the alchemical traditions of the Middle East and Egypt, and far beyond that in time. These are ancient mystery traditions that have been taught by word of mouth and by written language as well for thousands of years. And the teacher in the Middle East that people call Jesus and ascribe the Christ consciousness to definitely inspired many of these teachings, and this is the esoteric variation or interpretation of those teachings, not the exoteric. So we have to make a clear delineation between those two concepts. Exoteric is what is told to the uninitiated. It is sort of a cover story or something that doesn't really hit the bullseye, so to speak. It doesn't get down to the heart of the matter or to the center of the mandala, if you will. It skirts the issue because it is sort of a reservation of the real meat for the people who want to go further into the allegory, into the symbols, and understand what they really mean and what they're really saying about the human condition, what they really say about us. Secondly, exoteric teachings can be used for a methodology of control. You can keep back the real inner core teachings if you're so inclined to do that and reserve them for only a small select or elect group of individuals. And in keeping that esoteric knowledge, the real meat, in other words, you would be depriving other people of knowledge that could serve them and better them and enhance their consciousness, and therefore you would be in a power differential position over them, again, if your consciousness were so inclined to do something like that to information, and therefore you could use that weapon, use that knowledge practically as a weapon against those individuals who lacked it. So that is what the dark usage of occult information is all about. We're going to focus on the light Rosicrucian tradition, how this information can be used to free people, how it can be used to raise consciousness, okay? So the first thing is that it is the esoteric Christian tradition, and it is dedicated to the true spiritual teachings of Christ consciousness, okay? Rather than religious dogma, that has been built up around the story about the man known as the Christ, okay? That's the exoteric Christian tradition, and that's not what we'll be focusing on here today because, as I've stated very much and repeatedly in my work, and also built my work is, of course, related to the exoteric Christian tradition, is built upon the work of many others who have labored to expose the astrotheological underpinnings of exoteric religion. We're going to be basically setting that to the side tonight and talking about the esoteric teachings of this occult tradition known as Rosicrucianism. So we have to make that distinction clear. Secondly, we have to basically explain how these teachings are effectively communicated. They have been communicated throughout time in the form of, basically in two ways, in the form of allegory and symbolism. These are two communication methodologies that are favored in all occult traditions, but specifically favored in Rosicrucianism. Now, allegory, for those who aren't familiar with the term, is a way of teaching that involves telling people a story, through literature or through word of mouth or by poetry or even pictures, okay? And these stories can be interpreted to reveal hidden meanings or esoteric understandings that have been traditionally reserved for a small, select group of people that want to go deeper to the core of things rather than, again, as I've said, skirt the issue and just look on the surface. So an allegory is a story that is told in a covert way. It's kind of put off in a fictional way, but it's really telling about what's going on in the real world. So it's revealing a hidden meaning, and that is traditionally a moral lesson. It's teaching a moral tale, similar to a parable. It's a story about people who may or may not have existed, but it's explaining something that is applicable to the real world situation that we exist in, and it's teaching a moral lesson. Now, symbolism is very important to all occult traditions, and that's teaching moral lessons through symbols, through forms, archetypal forms often, colors, shapes, representations, things that are used to represent other things. That is often a heady concept to people who aren't symbol literate. They can't quite make the distinction and recognize, well, this shape is being used to represent this concept or idea. That's generally what symbolism is there to do, and symbolism plays a huge central role in Rosicrucianism. So we're going to look at those two aspects, but I want to tell people what the general overarching point of this tradition actually is. It is to get people through these communication mediums, namely allegory and symbolism, to recognize the existence and the eternal presence of the laws of nature, of natural law. Okay, you can call that God's law, you can call that the law of the universe, the law of creation, moral law, okay? And to align ourselves with that. That's what these teachings are there to guide us to do. To understand that there is natural law in place and to align our will with that will of creation, which was not set in place by mankind. Mankind is a part of that creation process, but it is our goal to align ourselves by our willpower with that higher force, that higher will that is directed by natural law. This, of course, really equates to the birth of conscience in another human being. And like other occult traditions, such as Kabbalah or Freemasonry, that is indeed what Rosicrucianism is attempting to convey. It is attempting to convey the definitive knowledge of the difference between right and wrong to the initiate, okay, to the entered apprentice into this tradition, one who wants to learn and is an apprentice under those who have already acquired and do indeed possess that knowledge of those natural laws and the definitive difference between right and wrong, and then can study that information that is then presented either in allegory, symbolism, or even in written tradition, okay, by written works, and then to choose willfully by one's own free will, okay, using their own consciousness, using their own thoughts, emotions, and actions to willfully make the decision to choose the right over the wrong, choosing of right action over wrong action. And ultimately, this entire tradition could be boiled down to a single tenet, which is the same single tenet that the true Christ consciousness teachings have always been about conveying, and that is the golden rule, to do unto others as you would have done unto yourself. Treat others as you would prefer to be treated. It is actually that simple and can be summed up in that regard. Unfortunately, so much is done to obfuscate through the exoteric tradition and lay down all kinds of controls, rules that don't really make any sense to almost put people off from that basic truth that that's what is necessary to be done in order to really change our reality for the better. So let's start by taking a look at some of the symbolism of this tradition. And, of course, the rose and the cross is going to be the first thing that people are naturally attracted to because it is, of course, the main symbol of this tradition. So let's start breaking down the symbolism of the rose cross itself. All of the symbolism I'll be talking about, people who may be familiar with other occult traditions will recognize has a symbolic connection to other traditions such as Christianity, astrology, alchemy, Kabbalah, Freemasonry, Tarot, and many others. Okay, so all of these traditions have similar symbology in them, and there's a reason for that. It's because, like Rosicrucianism, they are all derived from the same basic ancient mystery tradition teachings that have always been there to try to communicate that natural law understanding and the willful alignment to it. So I'll start with the cross, okay, because the rose is the real key to all of it, and I'll leave that for a little bit later. Let's begin with what the cross represents. Of course, people are familiar with the symbol of the cross because it is the main symbol of the exoteric Christian religion as well. But in Rosicrucianism, what the cross represents is basically the physical world. Okay, it represents physical incarnation into the world. It represents that we are having a human experience in a physical domain, but we are spiritual beings having that human experience. The cross is an archetypal symbol. It is often used to represent a central focal point or fulcrum, you know, like a bullseye target or a target, okay? You know, aim to get to the center of something. And that is what a cross basically represents. It represents the center. And in this case, it represents the center of the self. It is the spinal column or the archetypal world tree. Okay, in Eastern traditions, which Rosicrucianism delves into, but it is sort of like a complementary tradition in the West to Eastern mystery traditions that have traditionally been conveyed in the Middle East, the Far East, China, the Orient, etc. So the Western mystery tradition of Rosicrucianism views the cross as, again, the spinal column, the world tree, okay? It has been known as in other traditions. Again, in Eastern traditions, the tradition that teaches about the chakras, the energy vortices within the body, this ties into Rosicrucianism when we talk about the etheric body, okay, known as the vital body, which we're going to get to later on, the different components of the constitution of mankind, of ourselves, okay, the different aspects of thought and emotions, the quality of emotions. The cross is the center point of that spinal column, okay, that crossbar that goes across horizontally from the vertical. and it joins in the center to form four arms, okay? That center point represents the center of ourselves, and the center of ourselves is the heart, all right? The heart chakra is the middle chakra in the Eastern tradition. The Vedic tradition teaches about the chakras or the energy vortices within our body. The heart chakra is the very middle. It's the fourth of the seven chakras aligned on the spinal column. And this balance point, okay, this fulcrum point, the center, has just traditionally been used to represent the generative principle of everything, the point from which everything grows from, okay? It is the creative essence of the individual, the creative essence of all of nature. So that center point is representative of the center of nature and the center of the self. That's why the rose is placed at the fulcrum point. That's why it's in the middle of the cross. It's not at the top. It's not at the bottom. It's in the middle. It's actually at the fulcrum point where the crossbar crosses the upright. Okay, so that's what the cross represents. It represents physical incarnation into the world, us as spiritual beings having a human experience, the center of the self, the spinal column, the archetypal world tree, okay, of which the center point is the heart. And that brings us, of course, to the rose. The rose is the heart itself, okay? It is right at that crossing point. It represents compassion. It represents true care. It represents the generative principle, again, which is care. That which we care about, that which we focus our attention upon, is what we manifest in our reality. So what we care about is that the quality of our cares is going to dictate the quality of our life, basically. So we need to put care onto something that is higher than just the physical reality in which we live. We need to put care upon things like principles, upon things like morality, upon things like understanding, upon things like learning about ourselves in a deep way, such that we make a connection, forge a connection to the higher self. The rose represents the sacred feminine. Again, this is the center point, okay? If we just look at the language of why the rose out of any other flower is chosen, we'll come upon some alchemical green language, okay, which is symbolic language. This tradition is about resurrection. It is about coming from a place of unconsciousness and rising in consciousness such that we understand how the laws of nature and the workings of nature are constructed so that we can live more harmoniously within them, within that living dynamic system, okay? And we can become co-creators with that force. The rose, okay, is the word rose is the past tense of rise. Okay, and that's what this whole tradition is about, rising, resurrection, coming up from a deadened state of awareness, unconsciousness, and rising to consciousness. So this in itself is also green language, okay? And the symbols of resurrection in Rosicrucianism, we will often find, are very similar to some of the symbols in its sister tradition of Freemasonry, which also has tons of resurrection symbolism within it, and I've covered that pretty extensively on some of my podcasts at my website. To go back to the cross for a moment, when we look at the fourfold aspect of the cross, which you mentioned in the introduction, the four arms that come together at that fulcrum point of the rose represent, again, the physical aspects, okay, of our reality and of our experience. They are the four cardinal directions of the physical world, north, south, east, and west, representing that all are welcome to this knowledge, all may partake of it, none excluded, okay, everyone from all corners of the world, okay. This is not a secret society as such, as it is often thought of. Just like Freemasonry is not a secret society, they call it a society with secrets, but the knowledge of Freemasonry is open to everyone who wants to acquire it, just as the knowledge of Rosicrucianism is open to everyone who wants to acquire it. It is not held back from people, certainly not in the modern world. Perhaps it was in the past, but not today. So as such, this tradition is becoming de-occulted, or being taken out of its hiding place and being thrust upon the world, because this knowledge is needed now more than it ever has been, because we're at a critical fulcrum point or a juncture in history that requires this knowledge to be integrated. Otherwise, humanity is going to face extinction. That's how serious the juncture that we're at in human history. So, to go back to the cross for a little bit, the four arms, again, represent the four cardinal directions, and they represent the four aspects of the material world. We saw this when we looked into alchemy, the tradition of alchemy, and this is shared in common in Rosicrucianism as well. It represents the four material elements coming together, okay, being earth, air, water, and fire. We'll get to what they represent in a moment. And with the rose as the fifth element, which is ether or spirit, okay? It is the sacred feminine essence, which is the generative principle of care, coming together at the center, binding all of those other elements, giving them stability, okay? Or you could look at it as that's what the other arms are growing out of, because it, as the generative principle, care is what dictates the physical experience. So the four arms, aside from the cardinal directions and the four material elements, also represent the four virtues of Rosicrucianism. And these four virtues, as they are taught in this tradition, are faith, hope, love, and patience, being the fourth virtue, something that many of us, including myself, need to work on. Okay? You know, that could be a tough one, because we see the chaos that's taking place in our world, and we want the transformation in consciousness to take place more quickly. Those of us who are awake and paying attention certainly do. Patience is a big virtue that is attempted to be conveyed in this tradition, because it is taught that if we are patient, you know, good, much better things will arise than if we rush to try to do something. Steadfastness is a big component of this tradition and is taught to its initiates. In other words, willpower, not giving up, but also being the person who steadily moves forward, not rushing things. Okay?
Mark, we've been told that the last virtue was charity all these years. Is that not true?
It is the third virtue in the Freemasonic tradition and also in the Christian tradition. In Rosicrucianism, charity is not one of the four main ones. It is emphasized, of course, to be charitable unto one's neighbors, of course. But the four main traditions taught in Rosicrucianism are faith, hope, love, and patience. Faith, hope, and charity being the three traditional Christian traditions and those taught in Freemasonry as well.
Very interesting.
So as these four elements come together, okay, to make the foundations of the material plane in which the spirit or the rose is having its experience, we should take a look at how these overlap with some other traditions, namely the Christian and the alchemical tradition. And also, of course, the tradition of tarot, these symbols are also tightly interwoven into. So the four arms could be looked at as the four gospel writers or the four gospels themselves, and the rose could represent the Christ consciousness itself, okay, the awakened Christed consciousness at the center, okay. And the four gospel writers were, in the exoteric Christian tradition, were Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Again, it's all about these four have to be integrated. They have to be brought together and used in harmony with each other, in unison with each other, okay, in a place of balance, all in balance with each other, not any of them neglected, okay? And let's take a look at them individually. Matthew, traditionally, has been associated in the astrological tradition with the angel or the man of the great cross, okay? If anyone is familiar with the tradition of astrology, there is what is known as the great cross of the zodiac, this X cross, or in the other Western traditions, it is known as the cross of St. Andrew, with the solar cross of the plane of the ecliptic and the solstices and equinoxes being represented by the upright cross, like a plus sign. The great cross on the zodiac is often represented as an X, a large X, or a crossing, okay, of the galactic center, okay? So this is the cross that is represented by the four fixed signs of the zodiac in the astrological tradition. These are Aquarius, Leo, Taurus, and Scorpio. Aquarius, Leo, Taurus, and Scorpio. These main fixed signs of the zodiac are all associated with one of the gospel writers and with alchemical, each one being ascribed to a different alchemical element. So Matthew, again, is associated with the angel or the man, okay, of the lion, bull, man, and eagle, okay, and we'll see why that is, those attributes. Aquarius, okay, on the zodiac is represented as the water bringer or the man, sometimes depicted as an angel. This is the Matthew arm of the cross of the gospel writers. Aquarius is an air sign. As such, this has a correspondence to the alchemical tradition of air, which represents the human intellect, our thought aspect of our consciousness, thought forms, okay? How we can use our mind, our intellect, to comprehend ideas, to comprehend reality. The mark sign of the cross or arm of the cross represents Leo, the lion. This is the alchemical element of fire. Okay, so in the astrological tradition, it is Leo. In the tarot tradition, it would be the suit of wands. Just like in the tarot tradition, the Matthew arm of the cross would represent swords. Okay, so Mark is lion. He is the Leo aspect of the Great Cross, the fixed sign of the zodiac. This represents fire or our actions, what we actually do with what we have, with what we know, with our feelings, with how we care, okay? And this is probably the highest of the four physical elements, okay, because it integrates the other three. We have to take in knowledge, and then we have to basically use our care and our resources, but we ultimately must act. We must do something in the physical domain, which is what action is all about, and that's what real wisdom is. It's what we do with what we know. The third arm of the cross and gospel writer connected with the Christ consciousness at the center is the Luke figure, who is represented by the bull or Taurus in the astrological tradition. And in the alchemical tradition, this is a symbol of earth, okay? Earth represents our starting materials, the prima materia of alchemy, okay? It represents what we have, what we're born into the world with, innate qualities, talents, resources, capabilities, okay, that we put to work in the physical world. So we move on to the fourth arm of the cross, and this is the John figure of the gospel writers. This is represented in the astrological tradition by Scorpio, which has traditionally been represented by an eagle due to the Aquila constellation being in Scorpio. So this is a water sign. Water, alchemically, in the alchemical tradition, has been used to correspond to our emotional qualities, our feelings. Okay, so that's the sacred feminine aspect, and that's attributed to water, just as the goddess has always been attributed to water, the moon, and the sea. So that's the feminine part, the aspect that represents care. The goal of the initiate is to unite these four aspects of themselves. These are all aspects of the self. It's our intellect, it's our emotions, it's our resources, innate talents, capabilities, et cetera, and our actions, okay? And they're to be united in harmony with natural law under higher consciousness, which is what the rose represents, with true care, with the generative principle, or in other words, having the knowledge in hand of how natural law operates such that we are going to willfully co-create with that force and as such create order and not create chaos and self-inflicted suffering. Now, that's the basic symbolism of the main symbol of the Rose Cross. You'll notice that four is an essential element, okay, is an essential number in this, and also that fifth element being at the center, okay, that fifth element, the quintessence, the spirit, the sacred feminine, true care. That's what that rose represents. You'll often see each arm, the end of each arm of the cross, depicted as sort of like a three-leaf clover with three petals at the end of each arm. This number three is also very important in Rosicrucianism because we recognize the triune nature of the self as well, namely our thoughts, our emotions, and our actions. Again, resources, namely in the physical world, aren't part of that traditional triune nature. Thought, emotion, and action is what the aspects of consciousness are actually entail. But we need to employ what we have at our disposal in the physical domain as well. That could be, you know, money that we might have, or situations in life that we might be privy to, okay? Or again, as I've said, our capabilities. I might be a good communicator. Someone might be a good teacher. Someone might be a good artist. Someone might be musically gifted. These are all things that need to be brought to bear to perform the great work of helping to elevate other people to a greater understanding that is greater than themselves, that is the understanding of how this universe actually operates and how we should willfully choose to operate within it, again, to better our experience, to live in harmony with natural law and not create self-inflicted suffering for others or for ourselves, okay? For not only for ourselves, but for everyone else in the world as well. It's a shared experience that we're all collectively co-creating. So we could take a look at some of the orders of this tradition, but I don't want to spend too much time on that. I want to get to the allegory. I want to get to who Christian Rosenkreutz was, his story, the allegory that is put forward in some of the Rosicrucian manifesto documents that you mentioned. We'll look at Fama Fraternitatis, which is the discovery of the fraternity. We'll look at the Confessio Fraternitatis, or the Creed of the Fraternity. We'll take a look at the chemical wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz. We'll look at these briefly and just try to help people to understand what these allegories are all about. And hopefully that will encourage them to read them on their own and look deeper into them for the hidden symbolism, the hidden allegories that are contained therein. I also want to look at two of the major and most influential Rosicrucian teachers of modern times. And by modern times, I mean the past couple hundred years. And look at some of their work, and that is Max Heindel and Rudolf Steiner, because I think Their work is probably the most, it is at the forefront of the tradition, again, in modern times. So if we look at some of the more influential orders that have taught Rosicrucianism over the years, we can look at orders like Fraternitas Rosae Crucis, which is the oldest Rosicrucian order in the United States. I actually have an indirect connection to this order, although I'm not a member. I have a close friend who is a member, and he operates out of Beverly Hall Lodge, which is also operated by Fraternitatis Rosae Crucis. They operate out of Quakertown, Pennsylvania. It's probably the oldest Rosicrucian lodge in the United States.
Yeah, this of course is the famed Beverly Hall mentioned in the Mystery Babylon series by William Cooper. Headed by R. Swinburne Clymer, who is of course passed on in the mid 60s. So I am way excited to hear about that. Mark, before we move on, if I may,
sure.
Speaking of Mystery Babylon, in the series, Bill Cooper quote, if I can just quote him, he commented on the cross of the Rosicrucians, and hammered onto the crucifix itself, being the good Catholic that you were in your upbringing, I'm sure, phrase was INRI, I-N-R-I. And
that's right.
Here's Cooper's quote. It says, quote, I-N-R-I, or INRI, in effect, Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, which means, quote, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, end quote. And then continuing his quote, the inscription which was placed upon the cross of the Savior. In the Philosophical Lodge, and he's speaking of Beverly Hall, the Rosicrucians that you're speaking of.
Right.
In the Philosophical Lodge, they represent fire, salt, sulfur, and mercury. Here we go back to alchemy. In the system of the Rosicrucians, they have a similar use. Igne natura renovatur integra, meaning literally, and I'm sure the Latin student you've already gotten this, quote, by fire nature is perfectly
renewed whole. Yes.
Oh, so I just wanted to put that out there.
That's right. By fire nature will be renewed whole. Right. And it means that we're in a process of purification, and it may require heat in order to accomplish that task. And I don't think that it has to be that way, but I think humanity is pretty much choosing that it go in that direction, that we are purified by fire. I'd rather do it by an act of will, meaning that's also been associated through as fire, willpower,
yes.
Fire, actions, you know, but it's going to get done one way or another, either by an act of will or by tribulation, the fires of purification. So I guess you can look at it either way. You look at it in that sense, it will be accomplished by fire. So that is the esoteric interpretation of INRI, as opposed to Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, which is Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. That's the exoteric interpretation. The esoteric indeed is Igne natura renovatur integra, which is all of nature will be renewed by fire. Yes, or by fire nature will be renewed as a whole, as one. In other words, to come back to the point of oneness, fire is required. And again, you can look at that two ways. If we willfully align ourselves with natural law, the will of creation, then it will be done in an act of our own will, which has traditionally been corresponded to the element of fire, will. If we don't use our will, it's going to be done by tribulation, by literal burning or suffering, okay? And eventually we will see the error of our ways once we suffer enough and then decide to come back up from that torturous descent into a hellish domain of our own making. I would much rather it happen through an act of our own will, through conscious co-creation and our own individual wills aligning with the divine will or the will of creation, okay, with natural law. It would be a lot less painful of an experience for sure. But that, again, is a choice that is up to humanity to make. And we make that choice as individuals. And then those individual choices become, I guess you could say, amassed. And that creates a collective quantum effect, which basically guides the direction of the whole of our species. We are bound in that respect. And many people will look at that as an unfortunate binding, but it happens to just be the way that it is. We are all
yes.
basically tied together on this spaceship Earth. So that's why it's so important to reach out to others and try to educate them about these principles. So let's
yes.
start looking into some of the allegory, if we can.
And
we can look at
– Mark.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine, Mark, and I apologize. I just wanted to plug in there or tuck in there that
sure.
That intro, the small bit from Court of the Crimson King, that was in your honor. Indeed, the return of the Fire Witch. A Fire Witch in the ancient tongue is known as an alchemist, and you
nice.
Are a faithful steward of alchemy, assisting others on our progress, and mine in particular, as we try to reach higher stages of consciousness. The Fire Witch in that song had to do with the Magus Adeptus of the court of Frederick II, the last of the German Holy Roman Emperors. He was the last Holy Roman Emperor who happened to be a German. And at that stage, he was the court alchemist, or the court seer, so to speak. And when he returned, he had returned from a long absence in Spain to translate the Averroes, which is an alchemical text, you know, written by some Arab. You know, I, like I said, I'm a student of this, but I'm learning. But as stated, it was in honor of Michael Scott, who was the alchemist to Frederick II, a faithful steward to the last Holy Roman Emperor. And you are a faithful steward of alchemy to us, Mark, the people of the 21st century, desperately trying to break through all this allegory to find simple truths. And once again, I thank you for your voice, as always, my friend, the faithful steward of alchemy, Mark Passio.
Bob, I so much appreciate that. And that's a very interesting anecdote on that song and the story that lays behind it. Thanks so much for that.
My pleasure.
I guess I could take the last couple of minutes of this hour to just briefly go over some of the other orders in the modern day, again, of this ancient tradition. These are some of the more modern orders that came up to basically teach its tenets. And then I definitely want to spend the second hour looking into the allegorical tradition and some of the documents and take a look at some of the modern teachers and their work, and maybe even read a little bit from one of Max Heindel's books. So there was also the very famous Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, which combined a lot of Hermetic and Kabbalistic teachings with some Rosicrucian teachings and teachings of theosophy, etc. We have the Order of the Temple of the Rosy Cross. That was founded as sort of almost an offshoot of the Theosophical Society. We have the Temple of the Rosy Cross taught not only Rosicrucianism, but Kabbalistic teachings, astrology, Masonic teachings, and Christian mystical traditions as well. There's the Rosicrucian Fellowship, which is an order that I think put out some of the best teachings on Rosicrucianism, because it was founded by Max Heindel, who I consider one of the best Rosicrucian teachers. And he founded this order back in 1909. It was headquartered in Oceanside, California, where Heindel moved, and I believe that's also where he passed away. Max Heindel, as I've said, was probably one of the most predominant Rosicrucian teachers. He was born in Denmark in the mid-1800s, I think 1865. He was an esoteric Christian occultist, okay, taught the Rosicrucian tradition. He was a mystic. And, yes, he did die in 1919 in Oceanside, where he founded the Rosicrucian Fellowship. The Rosicrucian Fellowship was begun with the intention of teaching the true philosophy of esoteric Christianity, okay? And these esoteric Christian mysteries were intended to establish a firm philosophical foundation for the communication of those teachings. That's why Heindel came together to form this organization. Heindel formed this organization with others. He also wanted to establish a common meeting ground for people who were like-minded to him and also were into these studies, and a place for them to come together to basically communicate those ideas and basically prepare others through developing themselves, working upon themselves, to come to a place where they would truly be of service to humankind through the communication of these teachings. So I think it's probably the most influential Rosicrucian sect or order of the modern times, personally. But the biggest one of today is, I would say, definitely the ancient mystical order Rosicrucis, or the ancient mystical order of the Rose of the Rosy Cross, which is AMORC, Amor. It's named for short as its anagram. Yes.
Before we move on to Amorc, Mark, can I comment on Max Heindel?
Absolutely.
Author of the work, quote, The Rosicrucian Cosmoconception or Mystic Christianity. It is his magnum opus, so to speak. And you're right, the Rosicrucian Fellowship is the publishing they put out all these turn-of-the-century books that people can still find, these cloth-bound books about Rosicrucianism that are definitely competitors with the other order that you spoke of earlier, the Rose Cross Order of Beverly Hall Publishing that still publishes books. But Heindel's organizations put out a lot of the work that we can
right.
still get our hands on to read. And
That's right.
If I can, I wanted to put out about Heindel one of the more interesting parts of his history. During a partly rewarding, partly disappointing trip to visit Rudolf Steiner in Germany, Max Heindel was visited by a spiritual being identifying himself as the, quote, elder brother. This is all in the work of Heindel. This is their work. The elder brother of the Rosicrucian Order of the Inner Worlds, end quote, formed in the year 1313, which claimed no association with the temporal and physical organizations calling themselves Rosicrucians, Heindel was given instruction on how to travel to an area between Germany and Bohemia, which is what we would call Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic now. There he would find a, quote, etheric temple of the Rose Cross Order. Heindel explained that he was, for a period of time, under the instruction of the Elder Brothers of the Rose Cross, this otherworldly order being composed of 12 Elder Brothers, with the 13th as the invisible head. These profound
That's right.
adepts were described, which is just, you know, mind-boggling, this tale, but I wanted to share it. And it's, like I said, this is truth to the
supposedly
people who
wrote only this. Had vital bodies. They had energy bodies and not physical ones. And they communicated a lot of the teachings that he later set forward in his works to him at that time. Yes.
Mm. These profound adepts were described as belonging to human evolution, but having already advanced beyond the wheel of birth and death, just like you said. These exalted beings guiding mankind's progression in consciousness, known as the Compassionate Ones. I just thought that was amazing to read.
In Freemasonry, these types of spiritual beings have often been called guides or hidden chiefs. Some people might term them as angels in the Christian tradition. Regardless of what you call them or whether you even believe the story, I would look at this as higher aspects of the self or higher aspects of creation that are basically helping to push us along, or you could look at pull us along. They're in a higher place and they're pulling us upward. This idea is kind of borne out in Heindel's work on cycles or on the progression of the spirit. He has a part in his book. I'm actually sitting here with a copy, a cloth-bound copy of the Rosicrucian Cosmoconception. I think it's a 1930s printing. And I wanted to read a little bit from that later if we have time. But
sure.
One of the things that Heindel talked about in his book was the pilgrimage of the spirit and how it goes through cycles of descending into more dense matter to gain more experience and then ascending back up toward the realm of pure spirit. So we'll look at that when we get to Heindel's teachings. The final thing I wanted to say about orders is it really doesn't make a difference. I mean, you know, we could look at all the different orders and you could say talk about the most popular order of today, the Amorc order. Again, it's basically traces its knowledge back to the ancient mystery schools out of Egypt and even before Egypt. We can look at all the different orders, but they're basically all teaching the same underlying tradition, the underlying esoteric tradition, which is about consciousness, which is about the aspects of humanity, which is about how we should align our will to the will of creation and how we should basically modify our behavior in relationship to one another and basically to the needs of everyone who is here, and get out of purely selfish, ego-based consciousness, which is what the ascension process and the awakening of humanity is all about. So I have also taken a look at some of the writings of Beverly Hall, their works. They have an excellent library. They put out excellent books, too, for people to get into. So I can recommend that through an individual that I know who has experience with them. As I said, they are the real deal, and they are definitely teaching the true Rosicrucian tradition. So
I like that they don't discriminate with
a lot of these groups now do not discriminate between the sexes, and it is open to all, not like Freemasonry, which I think in a very outdated way still admits only men and has a separate order known as the Eastern Star for its women initiates. I definitely think that's a form of segregation that we could do without, and people need to come together as one, regardless of age, sex, creed, social status, or any of those things that divide us and put walls up between us, to come together for this tradition, the teachings of these traditions, which are timeless and should not be segregated according to any perceived differences between humanity.
Yes. Now the two orders that you brought up are the primary orders in America, the Fraternitas Rosicrucis, which is the
right.
authentic Rosicrucian fraternity, the Beverly Hall, which we were speaking
right.
of, that, like you said, still publishes under the Philosophical Publishing Company, and they have put out the mammoth amount of works out there regarding Rosicrucian.
Their library is huge. Yes. Yes.
And I bet you possess almost all these books, don't you, Mark?
Actually, I do not. No. It's some of them I do want to get my hands on, and probably am going to attempt to do that again through the connection that I have with that order.
This was
but
also
I don't
the
have
same...
many. I have many digital books on this topic that I have gone through. As far as finding physical copies of them, I have a few, but not as many as one might think. I do a lot of digital reading, so I do have a ton of them loaded on the devices that I have as EPUB e-books or as PDF documents. And again, I make a lot of them available with the drive full of knowledge that I make available. I've announced that on my show a couple of times and on other shows. I put out a 1 terabyte drive to people who basically send me a drive, and then I fill it up with a terabyte of information, and there's a ton of Rosicrucian documents on that drive.
Yes, the arc that you offer on your site, whatonearthishappening.com, and so if people are interested in your collection of knowledge, you very kindly put it on they send you the drive still? Do they still send you the drive and you place all the information on it?
That's right, and send it back, yes. And it's information that I've been amassing basically since I've been online, which is almost 20 years now. And I've been searching for this information and amassing it and digitally assembling it and backing it up. And I have a tremendous collection of digital information in my home. And I attempt to share that as widely and as freely as possible so that people can also benefit from it and help to change their consciousness and the consciousness of others as a result of integrating that knowledge into themselves.
Right. And we appreciate it, Mark. You know, now the Rosicrucian order that your friend is a part of or familiar with up there, like you said, yes, just out of Quakertown, PA, a very interesting little collection of buildings dotted with small pyramids around the property, and this was the home of the Rosicrucian order, Beverly Hall, etc., Philosophical Publishing, etc. But
right.
this is the famous, infamous Rosicrucian sect that Bill Cooper spoke about in the Mystery Babylon series. And as you know, Mark, he took a kind of a dark take on
sure.
it, and I myself would easily take a darker take on it, but for you in my world who very kindly are trying to share with me and others that of occultism. There is a light occultism and a dark occultism, and
I
am very thankful that tonight is the light the light aspect. There is so much darkness that you're right, we don't need to focus too long on it. However, in one of the works, Bill Cooper. Well, what I should say though is that to preface it is that the order itself was founded on the teachings of Dr. Pascal Beverly Randolph of Beverly Hall fame. And he is a very interesting character, as I'm sure you're aware of, Mark, turn of the century, he was mistaken for a black man. However, he had a very, heterogeneous lineage, to politely put it. He mm-hmm. was comprised of all different segments of the world's populace, and so he was easily mistaken for, quote, a black man. And in the mid-1800s, it was kind of tough to be an intellectual black man and to try to share your work. And one of his more interesting works had to do with sex magic. And at the time, in the that was just like, you know, way unheard of. I mean, one of his contemporaries was Blavatsky, Madame Blavatsky of Theosophy,
right.
And she had nothing nice to say about Dr. Pascal Beverly Randolph. But what I think is really interesting, even to this day, the website of this Beverly Hall organization of Rosicrucians can be found under www.soul.org, O-R-G as in George. And
right.
In the preface of it, of the website, they mention that Dr. Randolph and also another Rosicrucian named Hitchcock or something like that. But the other founding council member was Abraham Lincoln, who was a friend of Dr. Randolph's and a
right.
founding member of this Rosicrucian order of the council. And I think that is amazing and unheard of. In fact,
sure.
Dr. Randolph, to connect it, Dr. Randolph was one of the funeral cortege riders in the train to carry Lincoln's body to its final burial place. At one stage, he was asked by a very rude member of the party to leave the train because he was, quote, black. And he very politely
wow.
left the train, not as to cause a commotion.
Wow.
Back to you, Mark.
It's amazing. When you look into history, you will find that so many influential people had connections with occult orders and were occultists themselves. So they know how powerful this information is. They know that it's all about how the universe really works, you know. And the final thing I'd just like to say about the Beverly Hall Order is I have perused some of their materials, and I have looked at the library that they're making available. And from the information that they are putting out, it's difficult for me to accept that information is being used in a dark occult way, because it is a very high consciousness, so far as I can tell from having looked at it, and it definitely corresponds with attempting to communicate natural law principles to people. So my friend is also very wary of anything that would be used for dark purposes and is of high consciousness, and I don't believe that he would get involved with a group that was looking to subvert human consciousness and put us into deeper bondage. So, that's what I'll say about that. Again, I'm not a member of any esoteric order. I consider that I am a member of the order of truth that is has nothing to do with any physical lodge or physical individuals. That's a force that I choose to align my own consciousness with and then attempt to communicate the knowledge that is gained from that alignment to other people so that they can also make that same alignment with that force of creation. So that's who I swear my allegiance to no earthly organization or group. With that having been said, I think, you know, we've covered the order aspect of it. Let's take a look at now some of the deeper teachings through the allegories. And the first thing is the allegorical founder of Rosicrucianism, Christian Rosenkreutz, or R.C. Christian, as he is often known as. Yes.
Do you feel that you're missing out? And this is a question I've been wanting to ask you. Do you feel that you're missing
sure.
out on pertinent information by excluding yourselves from all of these orders and initiatory organizations?
I do not, because one, first of all, if your consciousness is expanded and you are in connection with an alignment with the spirit of truth. You don't need to go into any particular church. You don't need to go into any particular building or make any particular association with a group. This is an individual connection that is forged one-on-one with the divine itself, with that divine force, regardless of what you happen to think of that force or power as. And that is the connection to the higher self. That is the connection to the power of creation itself. I don't believe that any particular earthly path or any particular earthly affiliation is necessary to forge that connection. That is our birthright as beings that exist in this creation. And that can be done by everyone who expands their consciousness and exerts their will enough to make that, to forge that connection on a one-to-one basis. That's my answer to that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. And I step back with that answer. Thank you, sir.
So let's look at Christian Rosenkreutz, okay? This is the allegorical founder of the Rosicrucian tradition, okay? And the name tells the message. He is Christian Rosenkreutz, Christian Rose Cross. Okay, some people will say Christian RC, or they'll put the RC at the beginning and say RC Christian. For those of you who may be familiar with the Georgia Guidestones, which I do believe are works of dark Rosicrucianism, the individual who erected that monument was named RC Christian. This is a direct allusion to the allegorical founder of Rosicrucianism, Christian Rosenkreutz. So this was a tongue-in-cheek message encoded into the Georgia Guidestones, and I do not believe it was done by a light Rosicrucian, and I'll just leave that at that. So Christian Rosenkreutz is not an actual historical figure. He is an allegorical founder because he is the soul who has set off onto the journey for truth and higher consciousness. He is the archetypal entered apprentice or initiate into the tradition of higher knowledge. Okay, he represents the desire to go forward. He represents the spirit of evolutionary progress in consciousness. Okay, he is the force of evolution. He is also the generative principle, okay? The thing that is driving evolutionary progress is ultimately what we care about. We're in a stage now of epigenetic evolution. That means beyond the physical, beyond the genes or the genetic, the physical aspects of evolutionary movement, okay? We are at the point where now the decision that needs to be made is ours, as to how we are going to progress in our evolutionary development. Are we going to willfully align ourselves with the forces of nature, with natural law? Are we going to willfully align ourselves to right, willfully align ourselves to morality and conscience, okay? And therefore turn ourselves through an act of our own will into conscious co-creators of our reality, because we're always co-creating our reality, whether we know it or not. Most of us happen just to be unconscious of it because we haven't decided to take on the personal responsibility of using our will power, okay, to take on the knowledge of right and wrong, to take on the knowledge of natural law and align ourselves with it, and then make the reality that we want to see happen for ourselves by choosing, willfully choosing, the right action over the wrong action. Too many of us want to abandon that personal responsibility and hand it off to another that we just listen to and follow them, and therefore we're not really exercising conscience. Therefore, we're not really aligning ourselves with natural law, and therefore we're not really co-creating our reality with the force of consciousness itself, with the force of truth and natural law itself. And until we step up and take that responsibility, we're not going to become co-creators with that divine force. And we're going to experience a lot of self-inflicted suffering as a result of being unconscious co-creators under natural law. So that's what really the Christian Rosenkreutz allegory is about. It's about that force that wants us to step up and take the reins and become conscious co-creators, evolving ourselves, driving our own evolutionary force through an act of will. That's what the occult teachings have always been about. It's not been about following a leader. It's not been about worshiping at the altar of any other. It's been about emulating higher consciousness, looking at the archetypal higher consciousness or perfected consciousness that we look at as the divine or as God, and deciding, I want to be like that. Okay, so that's what we have to see the Christ consciousness as. We can become like that. We can emulate that. We can take that on in our lives and act like that. You know, I don't think the figure of Jesus, whether it's allegorical or if he existed as a historical figure, regardless of what you believe in that capacity, wanted us to worship him and just follow what he said. He wanted us to look at what he said, decide whether it was right, whether it was true, whether it was beneficial to all of us, and decide that we wanted to enact that way of being in the world through an act of our own will, whether we wanted to consciously choose, yes, this is how I'm going to live, this is how I'm going to be in the world, you know, and emulate his decision to do that. That's the decision that that being made, that that great teacher made. He wanted us to emulate that more than anything else, not to fall down at his feet and worship him and make a religion out of him, you know, centered around him. He wanted us to say, what was I saying? Look at what I said. Look at how I lived. And then do that. Do that by an act of your own will. Live like that, deliberately, consciously. So that's the Christian Rosenkreutz, as the allegorical founder of this tradition, is the allegorical Christ. He is the Christ consciousness, just like Hiram Abiff is the savior figure or Christ consciousness in Freemasonry. Okay? So the story of Christian Rosenkreutz is told in the manifestos of the Rosicrucian Order, and you mentioned them in the introduction to the show. We can look at what Christian Rosenkreutz's journey was when we take a look at the Fama Fraternitatis. As Bob said earlier, this was basically put forward in 1614. The Rosicrucian Order had, of course, existed for at least a few hundred years before that. And as I've said, this is an ancient tradition that goes back for thousands of years, really, the teachings. In the modern incarnation, some people say the early 1400s is when it really came into being as an actual esoteric order. So the Fama Fraternitatis is known as the discovery of the fraternity. And this means the uncovering, the unveiling, in the sense of to discover something is to discover it, to take the cover away or to take the veil away. Okay, some people will call this the tradition of the fraternity because it's talking about its core values, what its teachings really are, the ideas that it really wants to put forward and promulgate. Okay, so this document explains, it was put forward in 1614, and it explains the origins of Rosicrucianism, of Rosicrucian teachings and the Rosicrucian order. It talks about Christian Rosenkreutz as the founder of the order. Again, it doesn't specifically state allegorical founder, but we know that this is an allegory. It's not an actual physical human being, a historical being. It documents his travels. Okay, he travels to the east to gain more knowledge. Again, this is could also be symbolic, but again, it could also mean he went to the east to learn about the Eastern traditions. Okay, and then he comes back to Germany and he teaches these traditions and he forms the Rosicrucian fraternity, and he bases the fraternity on vows of piety and unswerving dedication to heal other individuals. And he doesn't mean in a physical or doctoral sense, you know, like a doctor would heal someone or a physician or something like that. He means healing their spirit, healing their worldview, healing their existential angst, okay, healing their imbalance, the spiritual imbalances, the emotional imbalances, within, healing themselves of their erroneous ideologies that are not based in truth, that are not based in natural law, that actually do harm to other living beings, okay? Healing their poisoned worldview, you know, their hatred for other people, or just their pure egoism where they only want to serve themselves and have no desire for the put any effort toward the service to others. In the Fama Fraternitatis, Christian Rosenkreutz also basically forms this building. Okay, he called it the Sanctus Spiritus, the House of the Spirit. Okay, the Sanctuary of the Spirit. This is kind of an allegorical correlation to the Temple of Solomon in Freemasonry. It really represents the self. Again, this is an allegory. It's a tale that's basically using symbolism and representations, one thing representing something else. Okay, so this temple, this Sanctus Spiritus, or the House of the Spirit, is the temple of the self. And we need to put the same care that Christian Rosenkreutz used in filling that temple with knowledge to fill ourselves with knowledge, with information about our higher selves, okay? So, it's an allegorical correlation to, in Freemasonry, the Temple of Solomon, okay? It's the self. It's the house of the self, the temple within man, as it has been called. The death of Christian Rosenkreutz is basically recounted and how he passed on information through word of mouth to others and basically formed a tight-knit unit that would then pick their successors in the order and hand down the teachings through books, allegorical teachings, and communication by word of mouth. The orders were given to keep the order secret for 100 years and then to come out and openly teach in the light of day. Presumably because perhaps it may have been too dangerous to come out directly in that time period. That's one possible explanation. Another possible explanation is that the people were just too underdeveloped consciously and spiritually to grasp the teachings until they had planted small seeds and then be able to work them up to a higher level of consciousness such that they could even grasp the teachings to begin with. And even today, there are many people who it would be difficult to put these gems before of these teachings because they're so willing to slap them right out of your hand in their ignorance because they've not really ever exercised the mind. They've not really ever exercised the spirit, the emotional qualities within themselves and the intellectual capacities that they carry. And they're very underdeveloped, just like someone whose muscles have atrophied in the physical world. Who are not ready to pick up large weights. Okay, it's the same basic principle. So it's a stepwise progression, and that was hinted at in the Fama Fraternitatis that, you know, many would not be ready to hear this, just that they weren't in the story of Christ, were not ready to hear his teachings, and so put him to death in a painful way. And again, this is allegorical. Trying to communicate the truth to someone is a battle. Trying to communicate the truth to someone often makes you hated because they want to stay in their level of ignorance and they want to stay in their level of not accepting personal responsibility. They subconsciously know that ignorance is equated with the lack of responsibility. And that's why we don't give children totally responsible positions until they have grown up and learned and understand more about how the world works. Then they can come into a position of responsibility. But, you know, spiritually, it's as if humanity wants to remain eternal, cosmic infants and don't want to develop any responsibility by way of taking on knowledge unto themselves. So that's hinted at in this document, but basically it's saying that the fraternity needs to communicate these teachings. That's what they're charged with doing. And that's their great work. That is their task. That is their labor of love, so to speak. Okay? So we could look at the death of Christian Rosenkreutz and how he was buried in the sarcophagus at the center of this crypt. And they put all these writings on the crypt, Okay, and his body was said to have been discovered again by an initiate of the order 120 years after his death, and he did not decay at all. You know, he was perfectly preserved, and his flesh did not actually decay as it usually does after death. This is also an allegory for saying that these teachings are basically eternal for the most part. They are basically truths about how nature works, and they will not really degrade with time. Okay, you could teach them now, and they'll be as valid now as they'll be as valid 1,000 years from now as they are right now. And the inscriptions, I'd like to just briefly take a look at these, because these are really this along with a couple of other basic tenets are the real meat of this document and the real core teachings that are attempting to be communicated allegorically. So on the crypt of Christian Rosenkreutz is written four statements, and then there is one that is basically an overarching statement. So we can liken these to the four arms of the cross and the rose, okay? The four, I guess you could say, underpinning statements are, they're all written in Latin, and I'll translate them accordingly. Let's see if I can get this pronunciation right. The first one is nequaquam vacuum, okay? And that means, by no means does a vacuum exist, okay? And what is meant by that in this teaching is that everything is alive. Everything has living dynamic energy. There's no such thing as empty. There's no such thing as some place where there isn't spirit. Everything is part of the all, okay? Everything is energy. Everything is living. Everything is part of the all mind, okay? This is a big part of Rudolf Steiner's teachings, that everything is part of the one, and everything is unified at a fundamental level. And quantum mechanics and modern science is telling us that there is a unified field level of reality at which there is no differentiation between anything, okay? This is borne out by modern science, and it's one of the tenets of all Rosicrucian teachings. Another one, the second one is legis jugum, okay? And this means the yoke of the law. And this means that natural law is always in place. Natural law exists at all times and places. And they say yoke of the law because we really are under natural law. Okay, we're not really truly free in the sense that we can choose to break natural law, but there are consequences for doing so that we must experience. In other words, the universe is like a huge mirror bringing back that which we put out into it. That's it. What goes in is what we experience. What we put into it is what we experience. So what goes in comes out. Garbage in, garbage out. Good stuff in, good stuff out. And it's up to us what we input through our thoughts, emotions, and our actions, what we are putting out into the field, okay? And then that is expressed in the realm of manifestation, in the material realm, and we experience it. This is unwavering. It is unbreakable law. It's immutable. The universe just works that way, okay? And this is a hard one for people to grasp. People don't like that idea. They don't want to accept the notion that we are responsible for what we are creating, but in fact, that's the reality. That's the underpinning reality. Nothing can change that, whether we like it or not, or even whether we understand it or not. So that's the second thing that is written on this sarcophagus. Another one is Libertas Evangelii, and that means the inviolate glory. That means the freedom of the good news or of the gospel. What that means is the gospel is basically the teachings of natural law, the communication of the knowledge of how natural law works, okay? And that's good news. That is very good news, okay? Because if we really understand that, we really understand how we are co-creating our reality, okay, we're going to align our will with that force, with that power of creation, and therefore we're going to be able to create anything we really choose, because we're going to willfully choose not to make natural law violations and thereby bring self-inflicted suffering unto ourselves. But we can't do that unless we understand how natural law works. And that's what is being basically said here by the freedom of the good news. This is the freedom that comes with knowledge, the freedom that comes with the knowledge of natural law and of conscience. And without that knowledge, there is no such thing as freedom. We could have freedom to express whatever we want to express in this realm, in this construct that the spirit has created for experience. What we're not free to do is just do whatever we want if it means harming other people and thinking that we could escape with no consequences for that kind of behavior. That freedom does not exist. And it's a shame that so few people recognize that and want to live in harmony with that. And what's even sadder is that other people think that you can force people to make that decision, force them to do that, and then try to be violent with them if they don't really understand that. That's what statism is all about, and trying to form governments to, you know, protect people from other people's bad decisions, you know, instead of actually teaching people what natural law is, how it operates, and how it is within your tremendous, great benefit to align yourself with it, and then to do nothing but teach other people how to align themselves with it if they don't understand any aspect of how it works. That's how you prosper to the greatest extent in this realm. And basically that's what's being said there. That's the liberty of the good news, the freedom of the good news, okay? The fourth tenet is Dei Gloria Intacta. Okay, Dei Gloria Intacta, which means the inviolable glory of God. Okay, the inviolate glory of God. And that means that essentially this law that has been put in place by God is its glory, is the glory of creation, and it is not going to be violated. It's inviolate, okay? Meaning it cannot really be violated. We can only imagine that we're violating it, but it's not really capable of violating it without consequence. And again, these are the tenets that are attempted to be taught by all of true occultism. All light occultism is teaching these basic tenets, whether it is the Kabbalistic tradition that is talking about the law, capital L, I'm not talking about man's law in any way here, whether it is the Rosicrucian tradition, the tradition of Freemasonry, the Tarot tradition, which is an extension of the goddess tradition and the goddess mythos, the alchemical tradition, or any other. Okay, these are the same basic tenets. The fifth thing that is written, and is actually written around the sarcophagus, is Jesus mihi omnia, which means Jesus is everything to me. Okay? The Christ consciousness is everything. Without that, there is nothing. Okay? So this is why it is at the heart of the cross. This is why it is the rose, the precious flower, the flowering of human consciousness, the flowering of the spirit, the eternal aspect of us. Okay? Our true nature, the higher self, the sacred feminine, true care, all of those things, however you want to look at it, from whatever aspect that you want to look at it, is the Christed consciousness, okay? And that's why this is the fifth element, not part of those other four, which talks about the law and the physical reality in which we live, okay? But this is the spiritual aspect, and as such, it is the quintessence, or the fifth element. And those are four very powerful statements if they're properly understood. In this document, the writer also cautions against false prophets who are teaching the false alchemical and Rosicrucian traditions and who are seeking false gold. And that means like the literal transmutation of metals, trying to manipulate things so that you get more in life. Okay, the alchemical tradition, as we have already talked about, is not about the literal transmutation of base metals into gold, but the base elements of the human spirit and psyche into higher elements, or alchemical gold, higher states of consciousness. That's what alchemical gold is. This is the Rosicrucian concept of gold as well. It is the sun, it is the light, the way, the truth, the life, okay? It is the Christ in consciousness, okay? It is one who has unified their thoughts, their emotions, their actions, and they come to a place of unison where there is no contradiction. As one thinks, so one feels, and so one acts, okay? You don't choose to do something that you know is wrong willfully. You don't say that you know something, but then do something different than that. What you know and feel and speak is how you live. That's what that consciousness is about. So that's alchemical gold. And the document warns about the seeking of false gold for profit, worshiping at the altar of Mammon, of the god of profit, okay, and, you know, profiteering off of other people. And, you know, just the ego-bound consciousness of I will only do this if there's profit involved. What's in it for me, you know? Another aspect of this teaching, which comes down in this document through the Latin language, is a phrase, aureum nisi quantum aurum, which means no amount of gold for gold. And that is seemingly a contradictory statement, but what they're basically talking about is you can never offer me any amount of worldly gold for alchemical gold. Alchemical gold is worth yes. more than all of the gold, physical gold in the world. So no amount of gold, meaning false gold, or worldly gold, for gold, meaning alchemical gold, or higher consciousness. Very powerful statement, again, if it's properly understood in its allegorical context. That's the Fama Fraternitatis. Let's look at the Confessio Fraternitatis. So I want to get to some of the works of some of these great modern teachers. The Confessio Fraternitatis, I won't spend a lot of time on. It is basically a further explanation of some of the goals or the teachings of the Rosicrucian tradition. It is known as the Creed of the Fraternity, and it conveys a deep sense of urgency at this time in history to begin to take corrective measures and change ourselves, okay? We need to make a change when it comes to human consciousness and to awaken to the Christic teachings, the teachings that help to elevate us to this Christed level of consciousness, and to embrace the understanding of natural law and most of all of the golden rule of treating others as we would be treated. These are all concepts that are essentially conveyed in this document, and again, it's with a great sense of urgency, explaining that if this is not done, that perilous times and times of suffering are probably ahead for humanity. That's the Confessio Fraternitatis. The third document, again, Bob brought this up earlier, is the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosencreutz, which is an allegorical story about how we are to make this great ascension or perform this great work of transformation upon ourselves, of transmutation of consciousness upon ourselves. And this is done through balance. This is done through the blending together of our masculine and feminine aspects. And I've talked a lot about this in our work. I won't rehash it. Again, this is, and I shouldn't even say my work, this is work that has been in existence since time immemorial and is a function of the universe. But again, I have talked about it in the podcasts and radio shows that I've put forward and in my presentations. But this document is essentially about the alchemical wedding. It is about bringing together the left and right hemispheres of the brain in conjunction with the human heart. Again, that's forming the great cross and coming together with the four elements and then the quintessence, the spirit of care, okay, the sacred feminine. And it's bringing together the masculine aspects, which are our actions, the logical thinking, the intellectual capacities, with the sacred feminine energies, which is compassion, nurturing, creativity, care, what we care about. You know, these are all the sacred feminine qualities of the individual, and it's not about male or female. That needs to be stressed. It doesn't make a difference about gender. This is all individuals, regardless of gender, have these qualities that are both masculine and feminine within them, and they're both good. The problem is when we get into using only one half. We become like an imbalanced being. So if we are too imbalanced to the masculine, we're not really at a high level of consciousness. We're going to become more dominating and controlling. If we're too imbalanced to the feminine, we give up too easily, or we allow ourselves to be dominated, or we don't pay attention to physical things that we need to take in hand and deal with as a result of living in a physical reality. So imbalance is where we want to move away from, and we want to move toward balance between these two aspects of the self. And that's what the chemical wedding is about. And if you want, Bob, we could put links to these documents. I could send you some links to these documents, or even like post them on my website and then link to them, something like that. If people want to download them directly from the description page, I don't know if you can put links like that up. But, if not, maybe I could put them in the What on Earth is Happening news page that I'm going to make after this podcast is concluded. And we can post to these documents so that people can link to them and read them for themselves and download them. Okay.
Based on the traffic that you get on your website, Mark, if you would like to link these documents to your website to where you've got my show link, that would be great. Thank you, Mark.
That's perfect. I'll definitely do that. Okay. So I want to basically wrap up for the night with just giving people some background information and talking about some of the works of two of the great modern Rosicrucian teachers. And I know I don't have a lot of time to do that. I wanted to read a little bit from the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception as well. Max Heindel, again, born in Denmark in the mid-1860s, Christian occultist and mystic, esoteric occultist and mystic, died in 1919 in Oceanside, California. He formed the order known as the Rosicrucian Fellowship, which I believe is still active today. And he basically put out a prolific amount of writings on Rosicrucian teachings. I have not read every one of them. I've read a few of them. And his, again, as Bob said earlier, his magnum opus, his great work, was the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception, which I highly encourage everyone to check out. Another great one that he put forward was the Rosicrucian Mysteries. And again, I can link to some of these documents. Maybe I'll post whatever digital documents I can find by Max Heindel and let people get a good cross-section understanding of his work that way. So I'll definitely post some PDF documents with the podcast. That'll be on my news section, whatonearthishappening.com. Click the news tab, and you'll be able to find in there Occult Empire, the show on Rosicrucianism, and I'll post some links with some of this work right there. Okay, so let's take a look at some of his basic teachings. Okay, he basically taught about the aspects of the world and thought, okay, and also of spirit. These are the core teachings that he put forward in the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. And he explained how these work together, okay, and how they create the reality that we experience. He also talked about the different aspects of the soul and of the body, okay, and he talked about cycles, what we would call cycles. He talked about the progressive stages of evolutionary development, which he called the pilgrimages, okay, the pilgrimages of the spirits, okay. And we'll just briefly take a look at all of these, because I still want to get to talking about Rudolf Steiner and read a little
Mark,
bit from one of Heindel's works.
Mark.
The Four Kingdoms. Yes.
Mark Passio, if you can, we can push this out one more half hour to in overdrive, if you wish, so you don't have
sure.
to rush. This is important material.
Okay.
And if you have the time, we can do an extra half hour. Great.
That's
then take
fine.
Your time, sir.
No problem. Okay. So the four kingdoms that Heindel talked about were the physical world, the desire world, the world of thought, and the world of pure spirit. Now, anyone that is even paying slight attention will recognize that these are the worlds of Kabbalah. The Kabbalistic tradition also teaches about these worlds, okay? The physical world, Asiyah, the desire world, which is Yetzirah, the world of thought is Briah, and the spiritual realm or our archetypal realm in Kabbalah is Atzilut. Okay, so there's a direct correspondence here, and of course there's a reason for that, because it's derived from the same basic core tradition. Okay, and again, these are aspects of the self. Okay, the physical world corresponds with Earth. It's the prima materia, the starting place. Okay, it is our resources. It is our talents, our capabilities, what we have to work with. Okay, the desire world. Okay, we're talking about the emotional plane. All right, we have lower desires relegated to the physical world, and then higher desires, what we want to work on about ourselves. All right, again, the physical world. He broke down the physical world into the dense body and the vital body. We talked a little bit about that. Of course, the dense body is just the physical body. He called that bone and flesh, blood and breath, okay, corresponding to solids, liquids, and gases. All right, bone and flesh are the solid, and blood is liquid, and breath is the gas. Okay, these are correspondences to the physical elements or states of matter. Okay, the vital body was the energy body, the etheric body, and we talked about how, you know, he told stories that some etheric beings or energy beings actually visited him to communicate some of these teachings. Again, you know, that's up to you whether you accept that on face value or not. Many mystics have often claimed to have encounters with etheric or not quite earthly beings that are of a higher evolutionary development than we are, and perhaps not operating entirely on the same plane or dimension of reality that we are, and can maybe phase in or out of it and move at will from place to place or from time to time, and who are helping to guide us in our evolutionary journey in consciousness. And that doesn't all mean that they're always mean that they're always good. Perhaps there are very good ones who want to assist us, and perhaps there are others who are feeding off of the negative energies in this world, feeding off of suffering and fear, okay? And they're trying to drag us down because they may be stragglers from another incarnation or from another cycle that we've already moved through, okay? And again, Heindel put forward that we can know the truth about these matters if we work upon ourselves enough. And I'd like to read a little excerpt regarding that, the knowability of this information. In other words, that this isn't just pure speculation, that we can come to know the truth about these matters. And that's why he termed this an occult science, as did Rudolf Steiner also term Rosicrucianism a science of the spirit, something that is knowable, not speculations, conjectures, or opinions, but something that is actually we can come to knowledge about. So that's the physical world broken down into the dense and vital bodies. Then the desire world has a desire body. And again, that was broken down into lower desires, which is, you know, what we want as far as our physical needs go, you know, food, clothing, shelter, sexuality, things like that. Okay. Then you go up to higher desires. What do I really want to become? You know, what do I want to be the qualities of myself? What kind of person do I want to be in the world? These are higher-minded desires, okay, which really is what humanity really needs to focus on and work upon in themselves, because they're way too connected to the lower desires and these lower aspirations, as opposed to reaching higher and developing the higher-minded desires of the desire body. Okay, the world above this in these four kingdoms is the world of thought. Okay, and this is basically where we work to create the reality that we experience, because mind is the fulcrum, is the focal point of how we create our reality through our thoughts. Okay, and then our thoughts have an inward expression, which is our emotions, and then they manifest together. When thought and emotion come together, they manifest in an outward expression, which is our behavior, our actions toward others, and that's what really dictates the quality of the conditions or the physical manifested experience that we live in. So he broke down the world of thought into the mind and the ego, Now, when he says ego, Heindel is not talking about the lowercase e ego. He made a distinction between the ego, which is the selfish desires or the things that only concern oneself with the roles that they play and their own needs, etc., which is what we would call ego, selfishness. It could be generally likened to, okay? He basically made a distinction between that and the higher ego. So when he's using ego, he's using it in the sense of the higher self. I make this distinction and use the terms, just the term self. The higher case S self is what he would call the higher case E ego, uppercase E ego. And what I call the lowercase S self in the work that I put forward, he would call the regular ego with a lowercase e. Okay, so this is the higher I. Okay, this is the higher self. All right, so mind was one aspect of the world of thought. Okay, and that's what we use to basically help us to determine what reality is, what the laws that govern this realm are, and how we should operate within it. And this is why the dark occultists focus so much on mind control techniques, because if you could take that fulcrum point, which is the actual center point through which we create our reality, because it starts at how we think and then it expresses through what we care about, then ultimately what we do. But if you could essentially nip it in the bud and change people's fundamental axioms or their worldview, how they think, in other words, you have them from the beginning, from the word go, and then they start to care about only what they think they should be caring about, okay, through what erroneous ideologies have been put into their mind or they've been steered toward through different methods of mind control. And then ultimately, they're not caring about things that really can better them and help to improve their conditions and experience, and therefore, they're not consciously co-creating their reality, even though they're always co-creating it. They're just not doing it at a conscious level. That's why mind control is such an important methodology to dark occultists, okay? Because they're all about wanting to control the outcome and no surprises and repetition and the reptile mind and basically getting people to go into lower states of consciousness where they can be controlled. And that's always done through fear. So the world of thought, very important. And the mind, again, would be that lower aspect of the twofold realm of the world of thought. Above that, you have the higher aspect, which is what Heindel termed the ego, what I would call the higher self, okay? And this is abstract thought, okay? This is actually where we're getting into, well, the lower region of this world of thought, the mind, focuses on concrete thought. Okay, but the higher aspect of thought is abstract thought, and this is philosophical thought. Okay, this is where the higher self begins to reason. Okay, this is what you would say is the function of the balanced neocortex, the human brain. Okay, the human part of the brain, the construct known as the human brain. This is where conscience is beginning to truly develop, where one is really beginning to understand higher abstract thoughts, meaning the workings of nature, how natural laws operate, how we can align ourselves and our will with that those workings, okay, with that natural evolutionary force that is inherent to creation, that we did not put in place, but is always there, okay? Whether we understand it or not, whether we like it or not, whether we even recognize it or not, okay? Abstract thought, the development of abstract thought through the development of the forging of the connection to the higher self, what Heindel called ego with a capital E, is the way that we come to know those workings. We come to know those ways that reality actually operates, okay? So this realm is of dynamic import. We have to understand how the realm of thought operates and how we should really be, in a way, aspiring to get up to that highest level of it, which is the realm of abstract thought. But there's even something beyond that. There's the realm of imagination, the pure archetypal realm, where really new ideas are born. Some would call this the void. Some would call this the experience of pure consciousness itself. Okay, this is what Kabbalists would call the realm of Atzilut, okay, Keter on the tree of life. And this is the realm of the imagination. This is the imaginal realm or the realm of pure will, pure consciousness, the will of creation itself, the driving evolutionary force that pulls everything upward, okay, through these other realms till it reunites with this force. This is true will, will with a capital W, as many have called it. And this is how we can basically get ourselves out of any mess that we've worked ourselves into. And without a connection to this higher realm, we're not going to be able to solve problems. Because if you can't imagine something as being different than as it is, you're stuck. You're not evolving. You're not moving forward. You're not really consciously creating your reality. Okay? This is why I've often said that the best definition for mind control is the extermination of the imagination. Okay? If you could exterminate someone's imagination, they can't ever imagine anything being different than how it is. They can't ever imagine getting out of a negative situation that they don't want to be in. They can't think their way through it. They can't change their mind such that they're not in the same cyclical repetitive pattern and they're going nowhere like a hamster running around in a wheel. And without the imagination, you cannot create what is known as the philosopher's stone. That is the prima materia. That is the guiding element. That is the thing that has to be born in an individual for them to truly evolve. And again, that is also helped with care, with intellect. Okay, it's about putting all these things together and integrating them. He's showing them, you know, separating and analyzing them from what could be construed as a left brain modality, but he's also explaining how these all need to be integrated. We need to put our physical resources at work. We need to put our emotional aspects of our consciousness into what we are doing to feel, okay, not to be totally detached from the situation, but to be passionate about what we're doing. Passionate about what we're doing. And we need to have proper knowledge, you know, not just intuition, but intuition plays a great role in coming to know something, but it can't be the only way that we learn. We need to have actual worldly knowledge about how things work, and then higher knowledge, higher spiritual understanding about how things are operating at a universal, fundamental, connected level. All right? And then we have to act. We have to use the will. And we have to use the imagination to guide the will. Again, to imagine how something could be and then work to make it become better. That's the four kingdoms that Heindel talks about. Okay? And I'll basically leave that there and talk about his way that he looked at the soul, body, and spirit, what we might call the mind-body-spirit connection. Okay, he looked at the body as having three levels or densities or aspects, however you want to look at it. The dense body, the realm of the physical, the vital body, the etheric or energy body, and the desire body, which was our emotions or the things that we care about, the driving force behind our care, which is the generative principle, as I've talked about many times. And this is basically the thing that we need to align our drive with, okay? The emotional the desire body or the emotional part of us, what we feel in the body is a compass. It is a directional marker, and that's why we need to align ourselves to it. We need to be allowed to feel the full expression of our emotions because our emotions are a compass, a directional guide for the way we should be living and operating in the world, okay? Without that guide, we're sailing without a compass in the seas of the cosmos, and we're going to be lost. And it's interesting to note, you know, the word lost means defeated, in addition to not knowing one's way. Because when we don't have the developed desire body aspect of ourselves, the emotional qualities, we are going to be lost. We're not going to have a compass, and that's ultimately going to lead to our defeat. And it's very interesting how language works like that. And it means two things that are so similar to each other. You know, both lost meaning both having, gone astray or awry, and you don't know your way anymore. You've lost the way, okay? And it also means defeated, because to have lost one's way is to be defeated.
Wow.
To have lost the way of the truth. The soul aspects, he also groups in the same way, and these have similar correspondences: the conscious soul, the intellectual soul, and the emotional soul. Okay, the conscious soul is, you know, our own individual monad of consciousness, I guess you could say. Okay, the what you would look at as the droplet in the undifferentiated ocean, but it's still a unique droplet. Then when it is in the ocean, it seems like it's a complete, you know, integrated part of that all. And indeed it is. But we could also look at it as the monad, or the individual drop that comes together to comprise the all, okay? That would be like our conscious soul. The intellectual soul is the part of the mind that we think with, that we look at as the I, you know? Or we can look at that as even the observer, okay? And the intellectual soul is the qualities that we use to basically dissect reality and look at the relationships between things. Okay, so this is guides our intellect. And then the emotional soul, again, this is the higher aspect of the emotions. This is the higher aspect that is an evolutionary force that is working toward guiding us in the right direction, toward helping us to understand that we are all unified at some basic level, that we are all in the same basic situation together in this experience. We're all bound together. And to understand that is to stop looking at things as separate and stop looking at, I have to prosper, I have to benefit, I have to gain, even if others suffer, and to make the recognition that compassion is the answer, and the recognition of oneness of all beings is the answer. Okay, that's the guiding force of the emotional soul, as Heindel put it. The other aspects that he looks at in this, what he calls the tenfold constitution of man, is the human spirit, the life spirit, and the divine spirit. This is the animating force that basically makes our way of life, our kind of life, possible. So the animating force behind the human being itself would be considered the human spirit. We could look at that as, you know, the breath of life that allows us to have the experience that we do in this physical domain, okay? Then when it leaves the body, you know, reincarnation is also a big part of Rosicrucian teachings, and both Heindel and Steiner get deeply into, you know, afterlife experiences, or what they would call between life experiences, okay, where we're not in a physical incarnation. And the human spirit, to go back to that, is basically the animating breath of life, I guess you could say, that makes an individuated human experience possible. Above that, you have the life spirit, which guides all living beings, regardless of whether they're human or not, okay? All individuated monad units of consciousness, if you want to look at it that way, okay? And then there's the divine spirit, which is the unification of all of these experiences, and that basically learns and grows from all of the collected experiences under the life spirit. That come to it through the life spirit, I should say. The divine spirit would be like that highest realm, okay, which is the all, which is life itself, which is the universe itself. Okay, and Heindel basically said that we are, all of us have a threefold constitution, and again, that's true. This is the mind-body-spirit connection, or what we could liken to the three aspects of consciousness being the thoughts, emotions, and actions. Okay, in the middle, he placed mind as a hub around those other nine aspects of our constitution. Because again, he looked at mind as the fulcrum point that the heart has to be united with. That's the whole goal. That's what the Rose Cross also represents, the unification of the heart and the mind. Okay, so the physical world and mind could be looked at as the cross, and the rose is the heart. And again, I've talked about this concept of the heart-mind, okay? Unifying our heart, or what we care about, with the higher aspects of knowledge, having acquired higher knowledge of self. They need to be brought into harmony. The balanced brain needs to be brought into harmony with the heart chakra, such that our actions, which will be guided by the brain, okay, will be in unison and accord with the generator of our experience, which is the heart, or care. In other words, the sacred feminine, or the heart, is what's really directing the show. It's in communication with the brain, guiding it in conscience, and then we're doing what the brain commands the physical body to do as the executive command center of the physical things that we do in life, or our behaviors. And that's what this tradition is ultimately teaching people, how to gain control of, how to ultimately come into conscious unison flow with, okay, unity consciousness between those two aspects of self. So he called the focus for that understanding the mind, with a capital M. And again, this is why the controllers of this world go to work on the mind. You know, they focus on that more than anything else, because if you're under mind control, ultimately you don't own yourself. You're not guiding your own actions and behavior. You know, you're not even seeking what I would call the operation manual for the self. You know, you're content to let somebody else push your buttons, and you're dancing like a puppet for them and their agenda, which isn't always pleasant. And I would say, for people who try to control other people's minds, the agenda is quite wicked. It has nothing to do with the achievement of the light, or of higher states of consciousness, or of personal evolution, or evolution as a species. It has to do with chaos, death, and destruction, and the extermination of forward progress, and basically keeping species back from what is their birthright, which is evolutionary progress forward in consciousness. So the only other thing I'll say about Heindel's work is his concept of cycles, okay? And he looked at the entire concept of time as a pilgrimage for the soul, as a pilgrimage for the spirit. He has this basic breakdown of different worlds, okay? And these are could all be looked at as periods of evolutionary growth. Okay, so you have these periods, okay, world periods, he called them, okay, and we would basically begin at a high level that is very connected with pure spirit, and start to descend through five of these, through four of these realms, okay, so it's a progress through four of these seven world levels that is conducted in what would be considered cyclical movements through five of them at a time. Then you descend, okay, four of them at a time, excuse me. Then you descend and you go one level down. So you're now descended into the fifth out of these seven world levels, and your experience is becoming denser. So you're progressing a little bit more away from the experience of pure spirit. And Heindel postulates that this has happened over cosmic aeons of time, okay? And again, he called this the pilgrimage of the spirits. And as we move forward through these time periods, which are seven cyclical journeys through these four regions or four worlds, that then progress down to a lower level, then a lower level, then a lower level. Okay, we reach the bottom of that journey, which is where we are now. And, you know, in Eastern traditions, they had these cycles called the yugas, which this is very similar to. In the yugas, they have four. Heindel postulates seven cycles. Okay, in theosophy, they also talk about cycles and have different breakdowns of them. As to which one is an accurate interpretation, I don't really think is what we should get hung up on. I think we should understand that what he's saying is that he's putting forward the law of the principle of rhythm, that evolution does move in cyclical progressions, but it still always moves forward. It's not just a circle that's flat. It's like a spiral, that progress is being made as the revolutions of the spiral are being turned. Okay, and then we move forward to a whole new cycle of evolutionary progress once we get past the lessons learned in those particular realms. So, you know, he has these world regions, the chemical region, the etheric region, the desire world, the realm of concrete thought, abstract thought, life spirit, and divine spirit. Those are the seven realms. Wow. So we started the realm of divine spirit, this is called the Saturn period, and go through seven cyclical progressions of movement from the world of divine spirit down to life spirit, down to abstract thought, down to concrete thought. And then we repeat that cycle seven times. And then we move to a new cycle that's lower down and goes into a more dense experience. And this he called the sun period, in the second period. And in at the bottom level of that four-world progression is the desire world. Now we've descended down into the desire region, or the desire world. We do seven more cycles there, or, you know, spirals, however you want to look at it. And then we go into a lower progression, in which we have descended from pure spirit and gone into denser realms once again. Now we have the etheric or vital body, okay, where that would be the lowest that it went during that cycle, which was called the moon cycle. Seven progressions through those four realms, from the region of abstract thought to the etheric region. Then we make another descent. And this is the bottom of the curve, because, again, Rosicrucianism, again, talks about the septenary, or seven. The number seven is sacred to this tradition. Okay? So Earth period is the lowest part of the cycles. In the entire progression between these worlds of spiritual consciousness, you don't get any lower than the Earth cycle. Again, this was likened, could be likened to the Kali Yuga of the Vedic tradition, okay? So at the very bottom of this cycle is the chemical region, epitomized by the physical planet of the Earth itself, you know, which, you know, if we were had a dark worldview, can be construed as being the hell of this cycle, which it does very much seem like. But Heindel's progression of the spirits through these cycles basically assures us that we will eventually make our seven progressions through this cycle, the Earth cycle, and or period, and then begin the ascent back up through these worlds. And three more lay beyond it, named the Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan cycles. Again, the septenary of worlds, the seven aspects of self, the seven chakras, okay, which we've talked about before, and are very prominent in the Eastern traditions. These are all correspondences to these. And it's also correspondences to the four basic worlds of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Okay, the descent from the archetypal realm down into the physical realm of Asiya, and the influence from below that realm, you know, from the Klipotic world, which is the force of involution, okay, the force of decay and chaos, trying to keep us down in that lower cycle, which is what we're really experiencing and feeling now in this cycle. And then the evolutionary force of the will and the imagination to come upward in consciousness so that we progress out of that cycle and into the higher realms once again to finally reunite with the essence of pure spirit. This is what the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception book gets into in detail, and the basic cosmology of Rosicrucianism as taught by Max Heindel. The other teacher I want to get into for the last few minutes is Rudolf Steiner. Now, Steiner was born around the same basic time. He was a contemporary of Heindel. Their teachings vary a little bit, but at the core, they're essentially the same. Heindel was born in 1861, died in 1925. He was born in Austria. He was a philosopher. He was an architect and, of course, an esoteric occultist. He founded the movement known as Anthroposophy, okay? And this basically means it's an esoteric science that basically means the way of human wisdom. So again, it's the knowledge of how the natural laws actually function so that we can develop wisdom, the actual way of being in the world such that we are operating in harmony with those laws. That's what Anthroposophy was about, okay? So the way of human wisdom, wisdom being choosing right action over wrong action, putting it into effect in the world, okay? We have the knowledge of right and wrong, and now we're actively choosing the right. So ethics was a gigantic part of Rudolf Steiner's work, and another prolific writer. I mean, I could, you know, rattle off all of the works that he did. I have not read all of his writings either. I'm going to recommend a couple and post some links to a lot more with the podcast for this show, and I highly encourage everybody to check them out. But Steiner basically postulated through Anthroposophy, a synthesis between science and the realm of mysticism. Or in other words, he wanted to bridge or create a union between science and spirituality. Okay, and in many ways, this is what we're really trying to do today, because these teachings really don't constitute a religion. To look at it that way is wrong. This is a science of the soul. This is a science for the spirit. This is a science which means knowledge. It's not about belief. It isn't about forming of opinion or even adhering to dogma. It's about understanding and discovering what is already in effect in the universe, which is what science is attempting to do in its own way. But an esoteric science is one that bridges the realms between left-brain science and right-brain spirituality and brings them together in a balance, which is what Rosicrucianism is all about, the fulcrum point, the balance point. That's what the cross represents. Okay, so Steiner advocated what he called ethical individualism. Okay. This is the understanding of the natural law differences between right and wrong, and then actively choosing through an act of will the right over the wrong. Huge part of his work, ethics. Okay? So another big part of his work, of his general philosophy, is that this is knowable. And I'm going to get into a brief reading with of Max Heindel about the knowability of a lot of this information. Okay? He taught that there were Steiner taught that there were essentially no limits to human knowledge if we applied our will. If we exercised the will, we could basically come to know that which we did wish to know. That the universe was not some grand torture trap by which we are thrust into it, and you can never really know anything. So in that sense, you know, people say, well, you can't really know those things. Well, sure we can. Why can't we know? You think that God is throwing us in a physical incarnation so that he could just torture us because we can't ever really understand what's really going on? That's definitely not the case. This is the kind of philosophy, or not philosophy, this is the kind of ideology that's really promoted by people who really are too lazy to do work upon themselves. And they want to throw out the idea that truth can't be known because really they don't have the willpower to set out on the journey for truth, to seek truth.
Yes.
And yes, in that sense, I would call Rudolf Steiner an anti-solipsist. He did not agree with the concept that There is no truth, and it's all just about perception. He believed in objective reality, that there is objective truth and that mankind can come to know it. And he promoted this in his works. Okay? He certainly put forward the idea that there is such a thing as objective natural law that is in operation, that we are bound by, and that we can come to know the operation of that law and align our will to it. He taught that everything is one, that there is underlying fundamental unity. This, again, as I've said, is borne out by modern science, which often has not reached the mainstream eyes and ears yet, as the unified field of reality. Okay? Steiner also taught about the triune nature of human consciousness and how to basically take control of those three functions of ourselves, which is our thoughts, our emotions, and our actions, about self-control. Self-control had to be a guiding part of individualism and ethical behavior, all right? That Steiner also taught that there is no such thing as true freedom without knowledge, that ignorance and freedom don't exist simultaneously. Okay, he taught that without true spiritual knowledge and knowledge of self, there can be no true freedom. Freedom is directly connected with us being knowledgeable of self. And if you're ignorant of self and how all of these things work together to create our experience, you will forever be enslaved. You will forever be under a yoke of control. So that was a big part of Rudolf Steiner's teachings. He taught that, like in the Eastern traditions, there is such a thing as reincarnation or a gradual progression of the spirit through different experiences, okay, in the physical domain. So we would have these experiences, and through them, we would gradually continue our learning experience in the physical plane to master the self, to become a self-master or an adept, okay? Another part of his teachings were the different paths that are taken by entities or consciousness or individuated units of consciousness, however you want to look at it, that are very similar to the Kabbalistic tree's paths, okay? He taught about the Ahrimanic path, the Luciferian path, and the Christic path, which once people really understand how this symbolism operates, it's not too difficult to understand that the Christic path is analogous to the middle pillar of both Kabbalistic tradition and Freemasonry, okay? The Ahrimanic path would be the dark path, okay? This would be like the pillar of Boaz, or it would be similar to the left-hand path. This is the dark forces. This is the hidden realm, okay? It would be like the dark occult side of things. It would be likened to the darkness. It would be likened to the inner aspects of the consciousness, but not the ones that are born out to the light of day. The hidden, the suppressed, the involution qualities of the universe, okay, aspects of the involution aspects of creation. And again, that which is hidden, the subconscious aspects. And Ahriman is this entity or force that is basically geared toward that level of darkness, okay? Lucifer comes from the Latin word light. The Luciferian path would be this right-hand path, okay? Correspond to the Joachim pillar in Freemasonry, or the right-hand path of the Kabbalistic tree. And that would mean the active sides of the self, okay? Those that are out in the light of day, those that are on the surface, okay? The masculine qualities, you can look at it as. But it's about that which we do externally to the self, interaction with the outside. And it's also about the evolutionary aspect to creation. Lucifer, of course, from the Latin meaning light, light bringer, lux ferre, bring light. So that's the light hand or right hand pillar. And then the Christic path is the synthesis. This is what we really need to aspire to make a combination between the masculine and feminine, not to play the games of control or being controlled, not to be more chronically left brain imbalance than right brain imbalance, not to be have more masculine aspects that are exercised within the self than feminine aspects that are exercised, to be well-rounded and in balance and in unison with the self, harmony, unity consciousness, thought, emotion, and action unified. This is the middle pillar. This is the archetypal spinal column of the cross, or the middle pillar of the tree of life, or the middle pillar of Freemasonry, okay, on which the heart chakra lay right in the middle. You know, it's the thing that leads to the opening of the all-seeing eye, as depicted in the middle pillar on the first-degree tracing board of Freemasonry. It is the Keter Sephirah on the tree of life, okay, that lies on that middle pillar. That's the higher consciousness that is a result of the synthesis between these seemingly opposing forces or polarities. So this is another thing that Steiner taught about, which has very clear symbolic connections to the Kabbalistic tradition. Ultimately, that's what Steiner was teaching, that balance is the way, and that's ultimately what the universal will is striving to achieve. So I think I've said enough about the teachings of both of these men. I'd like to briefly recommend some of the work of Rudolf Steiner. The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity is an excellent work by him, and The Outline of Occult Science is also tremendous. I recommend starting with those. They're probably his best works, but he has many others. And we'll post some links to all of these gentlemen's works. What I have my hands on regarding Rosicrucianism, I'll try to give a good cross-section of for the podcast, for the links in the news section of the What on Earth is Happening website. Now, I'll briefly read something from the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception, because this is about, you know, people will say, well, how do we really know? This is about the knowability of occult information in general. And this is by Max Heindel in his book, The Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. I'd also like to wrap up with something that Heindel wrote called Creed or Christ. And I'd like to read that last, because it really defines the spirit of Rosicrucianism in general, the spirit of the true light Rosicrucian tradition. So I'll finish with that. But in the intro to the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception, Max Heindel says this: so far as the vast majority of people are concerned, the three great questions, whence have we come, why are we here, and whither are we going, remain unanswered to this day. It has unfortunately come to be the popularly accepted opinion that nothing can be definitely known about these matters of deepest interest to humanity. Nothing could be more erroneous than such an idea. So Heindel is also expressing his anti-solipsism here, okay? Each and every one, without exception, may become capable of obtaining firsthand definite information upon this subject, and may personally investigate the state of the human spirit, both before and after death. There is no favoritism, nor are special gifts required. Each of us has inherently the faculty for knowing all of these matters, but, and yes, there is a but, and a but that must be written large. These faculties are present in all, though latent in most people. It requires persistent effort to awaken them, and that seems to be a powerful deterrent. He's talking about the will here that we need to develop within ourselves to become a true individual and a true initiate in search of the truth. Okay, back to the reading. If these faculties, awake and aware, could be had for monetary consideration, even if the price were high, many people would pay it to gain such immense advantage over their fellow men, but few indeed are those willing to live the life that is required to awaken them. That awakening comes only by patient, persistent effort. It cannot be bought. There is no royal road to it. It is conceded that practice is necessary to learn to play the piano, and that it is useless to think of being a watchmaker without being willing to serve an apprenticeship. Yet when the matter of the soul, of death and the beyond, of the great causes of being, are the questions at issue, many think they know as much as anyone and have an equal right to express an opinion, though they may never have given the subject an hour's study. As a matter of fact, No one, unless qualified by study of the subject, should expect serious consideration for an opinion. In legal cases where experts called to testify, they are first examined as to their competency. Where experts are called to testify, they are first examined as to their competency. The weight of their testimony will be nil unless they are found to be thoroughly proficient in the branch of knowledge regarding which their testimony is sought. If, however, they are found to be qualified by study and practice to express an expert opinion, it is received with the utmost respect and deference. And if the testimony of one expert is corroborated by others equally proficient, the testimony of each additional man adds immensely to the weight of the previous evidence. The irrefutable testimony of one such man easily counterbalances that of one or a dozen or a million men who know nothing of that whereof they speak. For nothing, even multiplied by a million, will still remain nothing. This is as true of any other subject as of mathematics. As previously said, we recognize these facts readily enough in material affairs, but when things beyond the world of sense, when the superphysical world is under discussion, when the relations of God to man, the innermost mysteries of the immortal spark of divinity, loosely termed the soul, are to be probed, then each clamors for as serious consideration of his opinions and ideas regarding spiritual matters as is given to the sage, who by a life of patient and toilsome research has acquired wisdom in these higher things. Nay, more, many will not even content themselves with claiming equal consideration for their opinions, but will even jeer and scoff at the words of the sage, seeking to impugn his testimony as fraud. And, with the supreme confidence of deepest ignorance, asseverate that they know nothing of such matters. It is absolutely impossible that anyone else can. That as they know nothing of such matters, it is absolutely impossible that anyone else can. In other words, what they're saying is, since I am so ignorant in matters such as this, these matters are unknowable. It's a form of solipsism. The ideology of solipsism. Someone who says, well, it's all just a matter of opinion and perceptions are the only reality. Absolutely not. Heindel is saying that an act of will can bring us closer to this knowledge. Okay? He continues to say, the man who realizes his ignorance has taken the first step toward knowledge. The man who realizes his ignorance has taken the first step toward knowledge. If we continue to say, well, I don't really think that I'm ignorant, and I think I have as much of this figured out as anyone else, even though I've really not given much of study to it, but my opinion is equally as valid. That's really the height of ignorance. You haven't really done any study looking into it, any work upon the matter, and yet you're claiming that there is not knowledge there somehow. That's the height of ignorance. So he says, the man who realizes his ignorance, though, has taken the first step toward knowledge. The path to firsthand knowledge is not easy. Nothing worth having ever comes without persistent effort. It cannot be too often repeated that there are no such things as special gifts or, quote, luck. All that anyone is or has is the result of effort. What one lacks in comparison with another is latent in himself and capable of development by proper methods. We are all capable of coming to higher levels of consciousness and development of the spirit by proper methods and will. Okay? If the reader, having grasped this idea thoroughly, should ask, what must he do to obtain this firsthand knowledge? The following story may serve to impress the idea, which is the central one in occultism, the central story of the occult, the allegorical story. This is one of the central allegorical stories of all occult traditions, whether it be Kabbalistic tradition, Freemasonry, occultism, Rosicrucianism, or any other mystery school tradition. And here it is. A young man came to a sage one day and asked, "Sire, what must I do to become wise?" The sage vouchsafed no answer. The youth, after repeating his question a number of times with a like result, at last left the sage, to return the next day with the same question. Again, no answer was given, and the youth returned on the third day, still repeating his question, "Sire, what must I do to become wise?" Finally, the sage turned and went down to a nearby river. He entered the water, bidding the youth to follow him. Upon arriving at a sufficient depth, the sage took the young man by the shoulders and held him under the water, despite his struggles to free himself. At last, however, he released him, and when the youth had regained his breath, the sage questioned him, "Son, when you were under the water, what did you most desire?" The youth answered without hesitation, "Air, air, I wanted air." "Would you not rather have had riches, pleasure, power, or love, my son? Did you not think of any of these?" queried the sage. "No, sire, I wanted air, and I thought only of air," came the instant response. "Then," said the sage, "to become wise, you must desire wisdom with as great intensity as you just now desired air. You must struggle for it to the exclusion of every other aim in life. It must be your one and only aspiration by day and by night. If you seek wisdom with that fervor, my son, you will surely become wise. That is the first and central requisite the aspirant to occult knowledge must possess: an unswerving desire, a burning thirst for knowledge, a zeal that allows no obstacle to conquer it, but the supreme motive for seeking this occult knowledge." I will repeat again: the supreme motive for seeking this occult knowledge must be an ardent desire to benefit humanity, entirely disregarding self in order to work for others. Unless prompted by that motive, occult knowledge is dangerous. And I'll leave that reading there. And the last thing I would like to read to close, I know we're running over time, but I'd like to close with a poem by Max Heindel that is called "Creed or Christ." And here it is. "No man loves God who hates his kind, who tramples on his brother's heart and soul, who seeks to shackle, cloud, or fog the mind, by fears of hell, has not perceived our goal. God sent are all religions blessed, and Christ the way, the truth, the life, to give the heavy laden rest, and peace from sorrow, sin, and strife. At his request, the universal spirit came to all the churches, not to one alone. On Pentecostal morn, a tongue of flame round each apostle as a halo shone. Since then, as vultures ravenous with greed, we oft have battled for an empty name and sought by dogma, edict, creed to send each other to the flame. Is Christ then twain? Was Cephas, Paul, to save the world, nailed to the tree? Then why divisions here at all? Christ's love enfolds both you and me. His pure sweet love is not confined by creeds which segregate and raise a wall. His love enfolds, embraces humankind, no matter what ourselves or him we call. Then why not take him at his word? Why hold to creeds which tear apart? But one thing matters, be it heard, that brother love fill every heart. There is but one thing the world has need to know. There's but one balm for all our human woe. There's but one way that leads to heaven above. That way is human sympathy and love." Bob, thank you so much for having me on tonight.
Oh, it's been quite a pleasure, Mark. And wow, you have just cast pearls, and I pray it is before the worthy. What a wonderful presentation of the mystery of the Rosicrucian tradition, or the Rosicrucian Mystery School. Thank you, Mark. Would you give out your contact information, please?
Absolutely. My website is whatonearthishappening.com. I am a internet broadcaster, radio broadcaster on the Oracle Broadcasting Network. You can check out my radio show every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time at whatonearthishappening.com. There's an extensive podcast archive with all of that data up there. I've done 104 shows so far. All of it is free. All of the information I put out to the world is entirely free of charge. Go up, check out that archive. If you're not familiar with the material, I suggest beginning from the very beginning, from podcast number one and moving forward. And in the news section of the site, when this podcast goes up, I'll put it up there as part of the archive, and I will have much supporting material posted with it in the form of books, PDF documents, links, etc. So, Bob, thank you so much again for having me on. It's a pleasure, and anytime you want to do this again, you just let me know.
Thank you, Mark. You're dangerous without commercials. You know that, don't you? You're dangerous to the power structure.
It's a nice treat, I guess. Yes.
Oh, man. I don't think you get to really elaborate on your show as much as you really need to, Mark. And so we're thankful here at Occult Empire to have given you this audience and this temple to share with us. It has been quite a show. Mark, would you please come back sometime?
Sure.
Well, thank you, sir.
Anytime.
Have a wonderful
evening. Let me know and let me know what you want the topic to be, and we'll put another show together.
Will do, my friend. Have a great evening.
Take care. Good night, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been Occult Empire 006. Thank you so much for listening. Catch us next time. Have a great evening. Good night, everyone.